saying that.
Well, I'm sure it's worth seeing twice.
Okay.
You get more out of it.
And then there'll be a question for you.
So today, I will make up for Thursday's lecture, which I think blew many of you away. The idea is I wanted to kind of get really quickly to this part of the course, which is fun and exciting and very conceptual. And so I tried to compress all that stuff into one lecture, and I think that was a little bit too much, probably a lot too much. But anyhow, suffice to say that you don't have to know all of that. And the problem that I announced that would be an assignment problem, that will only be a problem for students taking the grad virtual course. Because it's our fault. Well, we have a pretty good attendance today, so I guess it wasn't too scary. Anyway, I sent the notes to Monica, so they should be posted on the course webpage shortly, if they're not already. I just go to IQC activities courses, and we'll see. Yeah, you can. The actual lecture notes, though, will be available. Oh, really? All right, great. Okay, so you have two website resources. If you go to PI and look under courses, or if you go to IQC and look under courses. Okay, so yeah, Adam? Sure. Okay, so let's launch into this stuff. So today what we're going to do is look at the historical perspectives on interpretation, dating all the way back to Bohr and Einstein. And we'll go through what they thought and try to make sense of it and see what some of the problems were. So first, I'd like to start by pointing out some of the challenges to interpreting quantum theory. Certainly, you all know there's this indeterminism and uncertainty. I'm going to draw out three different aspects of that indeterminism. There's also coherent superposition in the wave particle duality. How do we make sense of that? And the special role of measurement in the theory. We'll discuss that in some depth. And then we'll see that the Copenhagen interpretation, which is the interpretation basically espoused by Bohr and Heisenberg to a lesser extent, we'll see how that deals with these issues and then look at some of the criticism of that view. And then we'll look at the orthodox interpretation, which is different from Bohr's view. The orthodox interpretation is mainly due to von Neumann and Dirac, and it seems to be the mainstream view or mainstream historical view. It has what I like to call a literal realism, and we'll see how that literal realism leads to the measurement problem and the Schrodinger's cat problem, and look at some criticism. So let's look at three different aspects of indeterminism. I'm not saying that these are necessarily independent, but they're different points of view or perspectives on the indeterminism in quantum mechanics. So first is just the plain indeterminism of outcomes that you all know. The fact that we have to use Born rule to interpret as relative frequencies leads to the fact part of the fact that we don't have a definite prediction. There's also the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which you all know, or maybe you don't know, because I'm going to draw this distinction between the Heisenberg uncertainty principle and the Robertson inequality, which really reflect two different aspects of uncertainty in quantum mechanics. And those of you at fourth year quantum course with me know about that already. We'll talk about coherent superposition and the rule of measurement. So, of course, if you have some observable A, except in the special case that the preparation lies entirely within some eigenspace, possibly degenerate, of that observable, the outcome you get under a measurement is not determined by the theory. So which outcome we get appears to be random, or is random, and the relative frequency is prescribed by Born's rule. So quantum mechanics is useful, even though it's not determinate in the sense that it gives us a statistical sense of what will happen rather than a precise deterministic sense. So thanks to Jen for helping me figure out how to lay out figures next to text. So I thought one of the best pictures of Heisenberg I've seen there. So the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is the uncertainty principle due to Heisenberg, where he considered the simultaneous measurement of position and momentum using a single experimental arrangement and showed that there was a trade-off between the precision with which we can measure x. Is that just we have to deal with the soil down here? Is that there's no stopping it? Can't stop progress. We will build it, because more is more. Okay, so delta p is the imprecision in our knowledge of the momentum of that one particle, and delta x is our imprecision in our knowledge of the position. In particular, delta x is our imprecision in our knowledge of the position of the particle before measurement, and delta p is our imprecision in the knowledge of the momentum after measurement. So while there's no limitation to delta x and no limitation to delta p, there's a limitation to their product. Note that this principle is inferred from a particular example rather than derived from the axioms of quantum mechanics, which didn't exist at the time anyways, but still actually can't be now. So this little exclamation mark is supposed to remind me that, so I remember when I was taking quantum mechanics in whatever third year of undergrad, first came across the Heisenberg microscope argument and Liebhoff, thought, you know, this is just bizarre and must be some way around it. Went to the library, got a whole shelf worth of books on quantum mechanics, started reading them, and blamed by him where I am now, I guess. And one of my favorite, one of my best reassurances I found was, I can't remember the author of the book, which is unfortunate, but at least this author was honest about it and said, you know, when we present this argument, really the reader should be left with the impression that insufficient cleverness has been deployed in trying to ascertain, rather than any proof that there's a fundamental limit. And that's exactly the point, is that it's just really a principle that's inferred from examples, which is exactly why Einstein, as many of you probably know, spent so much time trying to come up with a way to beat the uncertainty principle, because it wasn't a mathematical result. It was a principle that was inferred from examples. Now, we can understand the Heisenberg uncertainty principle as a consequence of Einstein's realization, and here's the exclamation mark first to the irony. So Einstein realized that, you know, when you quantize electromagnetic radiation, you're quantizing your best probe for measuring things. So now you're saying all of a sudden that the minimum amount of energy that photon can have, and its minimum momentum, is determined by some multiple of h nu, i.e. some multiple of its frequency. Now, because the precision with which you can measure something with light depends on its wavelength, and the wavelength is inversely proportional to the frequency, this tells you there's going to be a trade-off in what you can learn and how much you give, how much momentum you can give. So that's the first point, that there's this inverse proportionality, and also the point that this doesn't happen in classical electromagnetism. Because in classical electromagnetism, I can turn down the intensity as much as I want, no matter what the frequency is. So there's no fundamental trade-off in classical. And then just the side note that this was kind of part of the genesis of Bohr's idea of complementarity, which we will try to deconstruct later. Now, many of you must be saying, what do you mean the Heisenberg uncertainty principle isn't implied by the axioms? You know, I derived it myself. Well, what you derived was the Robertson inequality. And that's where you take delta A to be the statistical variance in outcomes given the measurement of A. And you take delta B to be the statistical variance, or delta B squared to be the statistical variance in the outcomes of a measurement of B. And then you can deduce mathematically from the fact that you have Hilbert space structure that there's this inequality, that there's a lower bound on the product of those variances or those standard deviations. And then in the case of position and momentum, which is what Heisenberg considered, you get this result, which is now a rigorous inequality rather than, you know, a slash sin equal. So that's the first point, that Heisenberg's result is a heuristic argument, whereas Robertson's result is mathematically rigorous. More importantly, though, is the fact that you are conceptually distinct. Heisenberg's result, you have a single experimental arrangement, you're trying to determine properties of a single system at the same time. In the Robertson setup, you have different experimental arrangements. You apply one experimental arrangement to measure A on an ensemble of systems, and a different experimental arrangement to measure B, and then you compare all of that statistical information at the end of the day and find that it has to satisfy the Robertson inequality. And so because generally the equality, the inequality is most interesting when you have non-commuting observables, this means you have incompatible experimental arrangements. So anyway, so that's a different take. So there's these three then aspects of uncertainty in quantum mechanics. Now another concept is this, the wave particle duality and coherent superposition, which I'm kind of throwing together as one topic. So we first know historically from 1905, Einstein studying the photoelectric effect, where he came up with his quantization of electromagnetic radiation, that there was a particle nature to light. It came in, you know, distinct quantities, distinct integer multiples of h nu. Then I forget the name of the experiments where they scattered electrons off a crystal lattice, Bates and Gerwin. And then they showed that also you had to think of the electron as some kind of wave, because you could determine the interference relationship to determine the amplitude of scattering from treating the electron as a wave. Although I've actually seen people argue that you can reinterpret that result as a quantization of the vibrational modes of the lattice rather than of the electron itself, which is the sun. And of course, the most kind of paradigmatic illustration of wave particle duality is, can you hear me in the back okay, by the way? Okay. Well, there's not enough room, I think. I'll try and speak, the full front row is available. I'll try and speak more slowly and articulate better. You know, I promise not to spit on you. So the double slit experiment is the main illustration of this wave particle duality. So I assume you all know the setup. You send a particle through two slits, and you look at the pattern that appears on the screen after the slits, and it shows up under a statistical number of repetitions. And the point is that if the system is not measured in any way or observed or doesn't interact with any external degrees of freedom, then you see a interference fringe on the screen. But if you look, or if there's interference from other systems, the coherence is destroyed, and the pattern on the screen is a sum of two probability distributions that you would get if the particle was just a particle, if the electron was just a particle. Yeah? So later on, we'll see. So some of you may, those of you who haven't actually worked through tensor product structure and how that impacts calculations, you can actually show rigorously how you know, the decoherence from measurement removes the interference pattern. And we'll see an example of that later. So one thing I find curious that didn't occur to me really until last year is that there's really two different narratives here. On the one hand, you can tell the story of, well, when the particle goes through the slits, it's a wave, and that's why it interferes with itself. And it's not a particle until it's actually measured at the screen. But then there's another narrative which says, the particle is actually a particle all the time. It's just that when it goes through the two slits, it's somehow simultaneously going through both. So it's not clear to me if those are consistent, if they don't seem to be to me. But anyway, so the point is there's some kind of ambiguity there, which needs, we need kind of a more fundamental interpretation to tell us how to make sense of that. Gina?
An incoherent superposition.
Yeah, but what would be the difference here if I...
So I put up a little chalk.
So this is, I think, maybe my idiosyncratic language, but if you have, assuming psi 1 and psi 2 are normalized, that would be a coherent superposition, and then an incoherent superposition would be the density matrix. So you have a superposition in the sense that it's a classical mixture of the two states. So I use this terminology specifically because, I don't buy the story of a coherent superposition being somehow, you know, metaphysically different somehow, right? That means the particle is smeared out or something. So I like to call this a superposition too, just to emphasize that they both reflect lack of knowledge somehow. This is somehow a coherent system we don't know about. This is an incoherent system you don't know about, but that's not my own terminology.
Right.
Yeah. So I think when lots of people say superposition, they mean coherent superposition. And certainly I do use that at times. So I guess from context, hopefully it'll be clear. So we'll see later when Roderick comes up with the Breuvel story or interpretation, you get a completely different story about what's really going on in the bubble slit experiment. And it gives a very nice physical picture with no ambiguous ontology. Now, the special role of measurement. This is another issue we want to bear in mind. So it has this unusual role where an intervention by an observer or by a measurement apparatus is required to obtain a specific outcome, one of these random outcomes. So in the usual description, kind of like pre-interpretation, the observer and, or the classical apparatus just lie outside the theory as interventions with the theory. And so the point is the outcome isn't described in kind of a consistent way. And this special role of measurement is made explicit, as we will see, in the views of von Neumann, Dirac, Bohr, and many of the others, where they both have different, where people have different points of view about the way in which measurement is special and how to make sense of that. And we'll see that in detail today. But in whatever the approach will be, you're going to see this awkward dualism in our treatment of objects. So the question is, can quantum theory be formulated without putting in some kind of special role for the observer? Adam.
Explain this strange double slit experiment using the axioms of quantum mechanics, right? But if we like just like we did last time, if we just incorporate the measurement apparatus as a quantum system into our formalism, then we get the loss of superposition in the double slit experiments, and we get rid of this dualism. So
here's the problem. The problem isn't the loss of superposition. So this is something I actually cut from a lecture, but I think I should left it in there. So the point is that lots of people have inferred, okay, I'm going to discuss the measurement problem later, so we're jumping the gun here. Lots of people have taken the measurement problem to be the fact that the state is a coherent superposition of two possibilities rather than incoherent superposition. And this is where decoherence has produced, you know, thousands of academic papers which emphasize this point. But for me, that's not the measurement problem. The measurement problem isn't that whether you have a coherent or an incoherent superposition of the two measurements. It's that you have, at the end of the day, the belief that the pointer position has some definite value, and the theory doesn't tell you that definite value. The theory just tells you, well, it's one of the two possibilities. So the idea is that you would like to say that it has an objective existence, the pointer position, and the theory doesn't give it to you. So that's the tension. So the measurement problem is, if the theory is complete, then why doesn't it tell me things that I know exist? So we'll get to that, but that's a teaser. So the Copenhagen interpretation is understood differently by different historical commentators, so there's not, you know, a consensus in how to make sense of it. The view is usually mainly attributed to Niels Bohr, and sometimes various elements of Heisenberg's ideas are included. But there was no consensus between them. So Bohr, for example, chides Heisenberg for his way of describing quantum mechanics. Bohr was Heisenberg's supervisor at one point. And so Bohr was very critical that Heisenberg would talk about the Heisenberg microscope setup for the uncertainty principle and say, well, our ability to measure the position and the momentum of the particle are limited, which kind of suggests that the particle has a position and a momentum, and we're limited in our ability to know it. But Bohr would have none of that. So I'll get to that in a moment. So anyways, the label Copenhagen interpretation was not adopted by either of them. So it's just a historical construct, as they were both at the University of Copenhagen. So Bohr's ideas are very difficult to parse, as you will see, because I have quotes. And in fact, rather than trying to give you some kind of close reading of Bohr, I'm just going to give you the quotes directly. And you can try to make sense of it. So complementarity is a very key notion for Bohr. Complementarity is that I'll read it out. Any given application of classical concepts precludes the simultaneous use of other classical concepts which in a different connection are equally necessary for the elucidation of the problem. So this is my immediate reaction. After thinking about it for a while, here's what I presume he's getting at, which is that basically when you're measuring, for example, the position of a particle, then you can't talk about its momentum. These are the momentum of the other classical concepts, which in a different connection, namely in a different experimental arrangement. If we're doing a different experimental arrangement, then we can talk about momentum. But if you're talking about the position measurement, then you can just talk about position. But the point is he wants to avoid you. So I think part of the reason why his quotes are so awkward is because he really wants to avoid what's the easy thing to do, which is fall into realist language, like Heisenberg. So he's taking great pains to avoid attributing any kind of realism beyond what you can directly say is the result of the particular situation you're looking at. So I guess he'd be horrified by counterfactual definiteness. The key idea is that there is no objective physical reality in the classical sense. And so he says, an independent reality in the ordinary physical sense can neither be ascribed to the phenomena nor to the agencies of observation. As you get puzzled by that last clause. He always treats observers as classical, so I'm kind of surprised he says that. Anyway, a subsequent measurement to a certain degree deprives the information given by a previous measurement of its significance for predicting the future course of the phenomena. Obviously, these facts not only set a limit to the extent of the information obtainable by measurements, but they also set a limit to the meaning which you may attribute to such information. Let's think about that tonight before we go to sleep. But so there are some key ideas. So Bohr really emphasizes this necessary boundary between the quantum and the classical. And that atomic phenomena are described by quantum mechanics, and so we can't use our classical notions of reality to describe them. But measuring devices must be described by those notions. So he says the experimental conditions can be varied in many ways, but the point is that in each case we must be able to communicate to others what we have done, what we have learned, and that therefore the functioning of the measuring instruments must be described within the framework of classical. But now all of a sudden you create this dualism, and then the question is, well, where is the boundary? At what point is something quantum versus classical? Certainly that's something which modern day experiments challenge a great deal. And we'll see that later in the course when Tony Leggett talks about fundamental tests of quantum mechanics on the macro scale. So Bohr also says that, admits that there's the impossibility of any sharp separation from the behavior of atomic objects and the interaction with the measuring instruments which serve to define the conditions under which the phenomena appear. I happen to love that phrase. Yeah, so he hasn't given up at all. I mean, he's sticks to his guns. In fact, he's used the textual dogma, so I'm going to let you read that while I grab some water. So this isn't to say that Bohr's ideas are the mainstream kind of textbook dogma. In fact, I'd say that's not the case. But at least some commentators accept it as more or less the final word. Yes?
Why is it a problem that this divide between what you call classical and quantum is a problem, really? I don't think it's a problem just because it's a bit arbitrary, because it seems to me that there will always be some things that will definitely be quantum and classical, and the concept is naturally, it's ambiguous to where the divide is, but it's not completely arbitrary.
Well, you're in good company, because I'm sure Lord would be very happy to hear you say that.
The way that I think about it is you don't worry about, I mean, you know there's day and night. You don't worry about when the day ends and the night starts.
Well, I'll make some more pointed comments as to why I think it's problematic in a couple slides. Criticism of Copenhagen interpretation. So, in my view, the necessity of postulating a classical concept or a classical conception of reality in order to even formulate your interpretation of a theory seems ad hoc. That's not a, you know, it's not a knockdown argument, obviously. It's just a subjective sense. But I was thinking about this a bit in preparation for the lecture. I thought, well, maybe it's not so bad. Maybe if we change the word classical apparatus and replace it with a more abstract notion like information, right? Then it doesn't sound as obnoxious or as not obnoxious, but as dualistic, right? Then we can say, instead of talking about the classical apparatus that serves to define the conditions of observation, we can talk about the input and output information that defines the task. So in other words, at any point I want to talk about some task or some process, I'm talking about the input and output information. And so that there is that kind of built-in divide between what I consider to be kind of input-output information and what happens inside the black box. So maybe it's not so bad. And it may be, in some sense, that just gives you exactly some operational view of quantum mechanics. But here's why I don't like it. Because if you take this term, and even if you use input and output information and, you know, act like a quantum information theorist, then here's what happens. You're saying, on the one hand, here I have this fundamental theory of nature, quantum theory. But you know what? I'm going to read it as I would read the instruction manual for some software I bought at Best Buy. You know what I mean? So all of a sudden, the interpretation of the theory is that it's an instruction manual. And rather than being about processes that occur in nature, it's about how to use it. And so that's why I find it unsatisfactory. It is exactly how we use quantum mechanics. But the point is that that's sufficient already.
And that using quantum as the instruction.
I mean, you can certainly abandon the notion of objective reality, but that becomes ultimately a very solipsistic point of view, right? Well, you see, you have independent, are you the only observer in the world? Do you have input, outputs? Are we all in this black box to you? You know what I mean? If you want to imagine that other people are elevated to the same status as you, then you have to imagine, at least in my view, some kind of objective reality that mediates between all of our perceptions. Now, this is very philosophical.
My question is kind of in contrast. If we were to do what you mentioned, the first point, in, say, classical mechanics, we remove the idea of classical measuring apparatuses, just consider input and output information in that, isn't that input and output information still governed by laws of classical mechanics? So it's not, in a sense, it's not similar ideas where classical mechanics is an instruction manual. It's still describing the input and output information. Whereas in quantum mechanics, it is not describing that information. So it is, as you're saying, just an instruction manual. Is that what you're getting at? That we want a view of quantum mechanics that's closer to our interpretation of classical mechanics, where we can describe both the information we put in and receive with the theory, and not just describe the processes going on with the theory.
I mean, I think that's what I'm getting at. I'm not sure exactly about how to parse what you said, but I want the same theory to describe everything. I want it to describe the information, the black box. I want one theory for all of that. In the back, yes.
Classical apparatus, Bohr's solution for that, will you be the only one? Who is to measure this? And we have a common language with which everyone would agree, and that would be his solution. It's not like he, well, at least in these quotes, he doesn't attribute a real nature to this thing. It's not like he's talking about reality. He just talks about a common language that we can communicate with each other, independent of observers of whatever. And that, at least I read it like that, as his solution to it.
Yeah, that seems like a cop-out, right? Like, sure, we're trying to interpret the theory, and he's basically saying, look, don't try to interpret the theory.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, I mean, you can read that.
So,
It's not clear to me like what sort of interpretation is relevant. If Bohr's view is that your theory is just the thing that explains the measurements you get, and you're constrained like living in a classical world to have what he calls the classical measurement apparatus, right? Like in what sense can you even interpret what's going on outside of the results that you can get in a laboratory?
Yes, I mean, I'm sorry, I've kind of spaced out for a second while I was speaking, but I mean, this is maybe referring to like the problem of cosmology, like we want to describe the whole universe.
Well, not exactly. Like you're saying you object to this because you have some sort of dualism between the classical measurement and the quantum theory that's describing this process, right? But I don't see couldn't you apply that criticism to any possible interpretation, just in the sense that in practical terms, like what you actually measure always has to be classical, right? Like no matter how you look at quantum mechanics, you're going to have some regime where ultimately the thing that you get out at the end is classical because, you know, you're looking at it.
Well, you're going to see explicit examples of interpretations which don't have this dualism. To answer your question.
Okay.
So the de Broglie-Dohm interpretation is one such view. There are also other much more trivial interpretations which apply for two-dimensional qubits, two-level systems. So I think when you see that, well, what Bohr says seems plausible in the absence of a reasonable alternative.
Right.
So let's bear that in mind. So thanks for all the questions, by the way. A lot of these issues we will get to, and we're just chomping at the bit here. So anyways, the other problem is, you know, where does the quantum classical boundary lie? We touched on that earlier. So there's a bit of a consistency problem. So you'd like to be able to describe the measuring device as a quantum physical system that's described by quantum mechanics. But Bohr's dualistic view says, no, you can't do that. And then, you know, back then, I think it was easy to take this point of view because there was such a huge chasm between the actual processes that were coherent and instruments that were used to measure them.
But nowadays, I mean, it's astonishing how much that gap has shrunk to the point where it's not even clear what's considered to be classical anymore. So you get macroscopic superposition and superconducting systems. And the last version of the course, we had Anton Zeilin talking about experiments where they demonstrated coherent superposition effects of buckyballs, which are like molecules with 60 atoms in them, and sent them through an interference setup and demonstrated their coherence. And so there are lots of examples of the fact that now we're pushing the boundaries of this distinction. And then finally, the main point I want to make is that really it's just a dogmatic assertion by Bohr that we just can't ascribe reality to a quantum phenomenon. And so Einstein was one person who just refused to accept that. And so one Einstein quote is, you know, to believe this, Bohr's views about the absence of atomic scale reality is logically possible without contradiction, but it's so very contrary to my scientific instinct that I cannot forgo the search for a more complete description. So, you know, I say, go Einstein. I totally agree with that. And I think it's really unfortunate that really one of the popular views is that these celebrated debates between Bohr and Einstein were lost by Einstein because he just didn't understand quantum mechanics. I think he understood it actually as deeply, but more deeply than the rest of the people who were debating with him. He just didn't accept that we should just give up and accept the theory as it is. So here's my kind of cheeky criticism of Bohr. So when I found this book, I laughed. So Heisenberg tells a story many years later about how he was out sailing with Bohr and some of Bohr's old buddies. You know, late 20s, early 30s. And Bohr's explaining to his friends how what he learned about reality in light of quantum mechanics and basically there's this absence of realism and only talk about specific interactions and not anything else, or whatever. I don't know what he told them. But the punchline is that one of Bohr's friends remarks, but Niels, this is not really new. You said exactly the same thing 10 years ago. So the question is, did Bohr really have a particular philosophical view that he brought to quantum mechanics? And because of his huge influence as one of the architects of the theory, managed to basically impose that view on the theory and was, you know, essentially unquestioned, except by someone like Einstein.
Tripwires?
No, I don't. I just...
I don't know what I said about it. But I would like to know if anybody figures that out. It's very interesting to know. So Einstein, you know, not in any public forum, but privately in a letter to Schrodinger, chided Heisenberg and Bohr, said the Heisenberg-Bohr tranquilizing philosophy or religion is so delicately contrived that for time being it provides a gentle pillow for the true believer from which he cannot very easily be aroused. So let him lie there. Okay, so now we're going to take a step sideways, and in parallel with Bohr developing his views, start recovering from a little cold. So in parallel with this, you know, von Neumann was formulating an axiomatic formulation of the theory and wrote a book about it in 1932, and with that proposed how he understood the theory. And it's, in my view, substantially different from Bohr's view. So the way, or one of the situations that led von Neumann to his view was to think about the projection postulate a lot. And recall what we described in the first lecture is that you have some observable with its spectral decomposition. And let's imagine for simplicity it's non-degenerate. Now we know that when we perform a measurement and we get some outcome, say AK, one of the eigenvalues, if it's a filtering type measurement performed ideally, then the final state must be rho K, because we can predict exactly what future outcomes of these measurements will be. So we know that that's the case. So this is necessary for the logical consistency of the theory at an empirical level. But how do we make sense of that? So it's tempting to say that following such a measurement, when the system is in an eigenstate, psi k, that it, indeed the system has the property a k, that this is some objective property of the system. And that this holds independently of whether you actually go and make the measurement. So if you know the state is psi k, then the idea is that any eigenvalue ak of some observable for which psi k lies in its associated eigenspace, that that would be an objective property of the world. So to use more fancy philosophical terminology, we'd say it's an ontic property of the system, or it's an element of the ontology of the system. I mean, it exists. So Arthur Fine, back in the 70s, identified this as the eigenvalue-eigenstate link, which really defined the orthodox interpretation. And he credits the idea to Dirac and von Neumann. So Dirac also wrote a treatise on quantum mechanics in the 50s, where he expanded a great deal about his interpretation. So here's a quote from Dirac. The expression that an observable has a particular value for a particular state is permissible in quantum mechanics in a special case when a measurement of the observable is certain to lead to that particular value, so that the state is an eigenstate of the observable. In the general case, we cannot speak of an observable having a value for a particular state, but we can basically only speak of it having an average value for that state. So in other words, what he's saying here is not only is it the case that we can talk about eigenvalues having definite properties when the state is an eigenstate of that eigenvalue, in the eigenspace of that eigenvalue. But actually, we can't talk about other properties that don't have that eigenvalue eigenstate. We're not allowed to talk about them having values. So now, just some of my thoughts about how to organize this idea to make the argument more formal, is you say, well, because pure quantum states are always eigenvectors of some well-defined observable, pure quantum states are the source of these objective properties of the system. So basically, it's really the state that is the property rather than the eigenvalue. So this is a logical argument that I'm claiming has to be part of this view, or is part of the view. But the orthodox interpretation goes beyond merely asserting that the quantum state identifies some of the possible objective properties through the eigenvalue, eigenstate, eigenvalue, eigenstate link. It's actually going to say that that's all you can say. So in this method of description, it is evident that everything which can be said about the state of a system must be derived from its wave function. Now here's where we have to be careful about the word state. So here, it must be that when he says about the state, he means about the ontic state. Because otherwise, the statement is tautologically true, right? If I replace the word state with wave function, meaning the quantum state, then everything that he said about the quantum wave function must be derived from its wave function. That's why this is trivial. So what he's drawing here is the distinction between the ontic state, using the word state to refer to the ontological properties of the system, and using the word wave function to refer to the quantum state. So just be wary of that terminology. And this is part of the reason why I stress the distinction between state and preparation. So you don't commit to the ontic notion we talked about before of the state. So basically, the orthodox interpretation asserts, doesn't deduce this, it asserts that there are no other objective properties of the system except those identified in this way. As a result, really the crucial conclusion is that the wave function provides the complete summary of the ontic properties of the quantum system through the eigenvalue eigenstate. So this basically means that the pure quantum state is the fundamental ontology. In other words, the objective reality of the world is just this vector in a Hilbert space. And this is definitely, I think, if I say this, so, but would you expect anything less from the central mathematical object in the most fundamental theory of nature? So, okay, I'm laughing at this because, for me, really, this is the psychological turn for physicists. And this is, I think, why computing scientists don't have as many difficulties with theory as physicists do. And it's because physicists takes a theory, says, this is my fundamental theory. The fundamental object of that theory is this vector in a Hilbert space. This must represent reality. I mean, it's almost kind of a naive psychological association. But I think, in my view, this is what drives many of the problems of interpretation. It's that kind of knee-jerk association. Well, I shouldn't call it knee-jerk, but it's that kind of simplistic association. And it's very much the association espoused by von Neumann and Dirac. And again, I don't know if I say this, but I think this is the main textbook interpretation. Yeah.
Trying to use the word preparation instead of state. Because when I think of a preparation, I think of a list of steps. Is that what you mean by preparation?
Yeah.
But if an operator is describing explicitly a list of steps, surely there are more than one list of steps that describe the output.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you have a one-to-one bijection between the list of steps and the operator?
Well, you don't. So there are many different ways you can prepare the same quantum state and be the same preparation. So it doesn't matter, for example, I can turn all the same knobs on the device and the color of my socks is relevant. But here we're talking about the properties of the system being prepared, so not, of the properties of my socks.
So what's the difference between the state and the output of the preparation? That seems like what you're describing.
Well, I mean, okay, that's a good question, and I don't really know how to parse my language properly to handle that. I guess somehow there must be some kind of background information which allows you to know what's relevant and what's not relevant. So it's the preparation of some system which, I predefine that system is an electron, that little thing's associated with electron nets, right? So I can measure its spin, I can measure its momentum, I can, measure its energy, I can deflect charged particles off of it. So I think that there's some notion of relevant properties, and it's a preparation of those relevant properties, and that's somehow implicit in the discussion.
The list of steps.
No, I'm saying that there's a list of steps, which is non-unique, which leads to a particular disposition of the system.
Steps that you're interested in. What do you mean by the codes?
It is a list. It's just a list. There's an instruction set. And that instruction set, there's many different instruction sets which produce the electron in the same disposition, such that all the empirically predicted statistics are the same. So in other words,
I can write down a list of the types of measurements I can make on this electron system, such as its spin, its momentum. And the idea is there are going to be equivalence classes of preparation procedures which will produce the same sets of statistics for that list of possible measurements. And similarly, each measurement in that list will be non-unique. So there'll be different ways of making that measurement which produces the same set of statistics for different sets of equivalence classes of preparation. Now, the best treatment of this that I know of is by Rob Speckens, a paper on contextuality, where he really emphasizes that distinction. Victor.
Interpretation escapes Bohr's objection, really, which is that, even if you say that the objective reality of the world is a quantum wave function, right? Then at any point in actually using the theory, you still have to introduce that divide between classical and quantum, right? But are these?
Oh, it has to the same objection applies to this.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll see. I'll get to that in a minute.
I guess my question was: this seems to imply that a measurement can change the ontic state of a system, even if that measurement is, say, you measure, you know that the ontic state is that it's at this position. You measure momentum. You lose that on that state of position and gain in position momentum. Did they not find that troubling at all?
That in spades for sure. Yes.
To me, physical properties shouldn't.
Well, yes, exactly. This is one of the major paradoxes of this view.
You probably read a lot more than I have before, but from what you had on his comments, none of that ever implied that he said there was a fundamental quantum world and a fundamental classical world and there's this divide. The only thing that said that was a quote from the textbook.
Yeah.
So this sort of attributing that to what Bohr said, I think is a little
bit. I don't know what about fundamental, but he definitely insisted that there was a boundary in that one quote, that you have to delineate a boundary. And that boundary was malleable, he also acknowledged. So it kind of depended on what you were trying to do. Jen?
Did he say why delineating the boundary is necessary? Like, is he talking about from a fundamental understanding point of view, or just from a applications point of view?
I don't know, but my guess is applications very much. basically you have to define your problem by its input-output. And then you have some second process that takes the output. Well, now all of a sudden you combine those two boxes and have a bigger box. So, sometimes you can.
I would use the word operational instead of application.
Yeah, operational. I kind of came to that myself last weekend. He was kind of an operationalist, really, which is, I think, the operational interpretation of quantum mechanics, which we'll discuss in the next section. Is kind of the user's manual for quantum mechanics. How do you actually do stuff with quantum mechanics? And it's all you need to do stuff with quantum mechanics.
How does this interpretation deal with superposition, and how does it view that?
Oh, okay, we'll get to that, yeah. It's Jordan, right?
Yeah.
I forgot your name.
Dave. Based on point number 3 there, is this implying that there's no underlying theory? Like, quantum mechanics is it, and there can't be anything else?
Yes, exactly implying that.
Okay.
And we're getting to that. You guys are jumping the gun. This is good. Okay. So
use the word, cop-out. That sounds like the ultimate.
What does?
That saying, this is it. Don't worry about it. Search for another theory.
It may be the case, of course. So it's, I'm not, I don't have any, I can't prove to you that this is wrong.
Or it's lacking. It's great.
Outside of going in?
It's nothing. I don't see how point 3 follows directly from the quote, though, because the first sentence is within this method of description.
Yes, no, I agree. So here, basically, I couldn't. If I was writing a thesis on this, I would try to line up all the quotes to justify each of these logical turns, but I can't do that. So, yes, you have to take it on faith. And I'm not even promising you that, this is, von Neumann isn't turning in his grave and attributing this idea to it. So, I'm just building this up as some kind of construct. as a straw man, so to speak, which we will later criticize.
Thanks for catching.
Okay, so here's where now we got, where are we? Okay, so now we make this hypothesis that the state is literally real, and then I'd like to distinguish that. Okay, well, we make this hypothesis that the quantum state is real. I should put the word literally there. And moreover, that it provides the complete ontology, which means it's kind of the literal reality. So when the word literal for me is supposed to emphasize the fact that it's the complete ontology as opposed to part of the ontology. Leads to some difficult issues when we consider the measurement process. So again, consider some observable for this spectral decomposition, and we have the Luders rule, which determines the state after measurement. Of course, as before, I've noted that if the spectral decomposition is in terms of rank one projectors, then the final state is just some eigenstate. And that's just Vindelmann's process one. So the point is that this projection postulate cannot be deduced from the usual unitary evolution of the Schrodinger equation. This is a bit of a digression now. Just to prove to you that it's not as though we've missed something. It may be actually, this is implied by the unitary evolution if we just look at the math carefully. So we'll show that that's not the case. You can see conceptually how they're different. Unitary evolution is deterministic. The final quantum state is fixed by the initial quantum state, but the collapse process associated with measurement is fundamentally indeterministic. The final state is conditional upon what outcome I get, and if I repeat the experiment different times and get different outcomes, I get different final states with the same initial state. So this is a variation of possible output states under the projection postulate, whereas under unitary evolution, there's a fixed final state, by which I mean preparation. So anyways, is it actually possible that in spite of this apparent contradiction, we can nonetheless derive projection postulate by considering a unitary evolution of the system plus apparatus plus arbitrary other degrees of freedom?
Yes. The question is that really such a problem with this interpretation? Because they seem to be specify very clearly that it only applies to the eigenstates and the eigenvectors, or eigenvalues. So in the case where you're getting different results, if you have a pure state, you're not measuring in the correct bases. If you're measuring the correct bases, you are always going to get the same measurement. So I don't see, for pure states anyway, I don't see how that this really is a problem in their interpretation. It seems to me you just have chosen the wrong measurement form.
No. But the point is you have a freedom in what measurement you choose. So yes, if I perform a measurement on a state which happens to be an eigenstate of my measurement, then yeah, nothing special happens actually. But it's really specifically the case when I have, a preparation procedure based on a filtering measurement of some observable A, and then I perform a subsequent measurement B of some non that does not commute with A.
Right.
So that B's spectral decomposition will not include any of the eigenstates of A. And then I necessarily have this stochastic set of outcomes.
Okay, I guess that's what I was asking for then. I thought they were deciding that the ontic state could just be that eigenvalue in that particular basis, that it had no object, there's nothing you could say about the reality of the state other than in that measurement basis.
Well, I guess the point is that you have this continuously evolving quantum state, and that means you have this kind of moving, the quantum state starts out as an eigenstate of this X component of spin, and then now, at this point in time, X spin is real. The eigenvalues of X spin are actual. Then it rotates over to Y. You say, okay, now at this point in time, the actual physical property of the world is that the Y eigenvalue is, the true.
That is really weird when you throw it that way.
And then you go back and you measure Z, and then all of a sudden you jump to one of the two possible outcomes of the Z measurement.
Okay.
Jump.
Maybe
it's a good
sign or something else. But is the unitary evolution actually deterministic?
Yes. It's deterministic on the Hilbert space.
Wait, that's in a conceptual sense. Like if you say I'm going to take an electron in the ground state and I'm going to excite it to the first excited state, you can't do that deterministically, can you?
Sorry?
If your ground state is your zero state and your excited state is your one state.
Yes, you're right. So that's a cheeky. Okay, yeah. So it is. So you know the initial state of the atom, and you apply the right pulse. You can rotate it continuously to. But it's deterministic in the sense that if you apply whatever it takes, you know, a pi pulse, take you from the first ground state, the zeroth state to the first ground state. The process is deterministic in the sense that it's repeatable. You know, remove all the noise from your experiment. We're describing ideal quantum mechanics here. That what really happens. And then you're always going to find the one state if you apply the right pulse. So there exists some unitary, which if you could apply it with perfect reliability, there exists some pulse, which if you could apply it with perfect repetition, would give you always the same outcome state. So the determinism is on the Hilbert space. So it's the Hilbert space vector that's determined, right? That's all that's determined. Outcomes of other measurements aren't determined. It's just the Hilbert space vector. So let's just look at a simple model of an atom described by some pure state, which is moving along two distinct trajectories in physical space. So there's two distinct trajectories, a left trajectory and a right trajectory. And we want to arrange it so that we have some apparatus or detector that both trajectories go through. And this detector is going to have a pointer on it, and that pointer is going to move to the left if it finds the particle in the left region, and it's going to move to the right if it finds the particle in the right region. Sorry, let's just replace up with right, with left and down with right there. That's unnecessary. So the point is there are two states. Now, because we want to be completely general, and because I spent Thursday's lecture proving to you that we only need the ideal axioms to describe anything that happens by all those, you know, Neimark and, you know, Steinsprenk dilation theorems, we know that you don't get anything new by looking at, you know, open systems. As long as you add an extra Hilbert space, you get an equivalent representation of anything that can happen in a lab by looking at unitaries acting on state vectors. So that was the take-home message from Thursday's lecture. So we're adding this extra chi state, which is an extra piece of Hilbert space somewhere, which can be anything you want it to be. It can be the color of your socks, it can be the dust particles, it can be, you know, whatever you want. But now the point is, the device is a good measurement device, and it has this faithful measurement aspect to it, which means that if I put in the up state, and the device pointer is in the middle, in the ready state, and I put in any environmental state chi, then because my device works properly, the pointer is going to move from ready to the left position whenever the input state is up. And because it works properly also for the other outcome, whenever I put in just the down state, it moves to the right position. Yeah?
Aren't you assigning a wave function here, the ready kind of to the ontic state of your measurement apparatus? Because you're saying it goes to left. Right? So what do you mean? So you see it go left. So it's really left, right? So you have that.
The center of mass position of the pointer is a degree of freedom which has a Hilbert space. And it's a vector in that Hilbert space associated with the center of mass being moved to the right. Is that satisfactory? Okay. No, I mean, is it? I don't need to be, like, pushy. Is that right?
Yeah,
does that make sense? I mean, so now the key, what I've done with the full generality, actually, is I've allowed chi prime and chi double prime to be different. So, you know, there could have been different kinds of disturbances to any other aspects of the universe under these two distinct processes. Now, it may be that we want to consider chi prime and chi double prime to be the same, but for complete generality, I allow them to be different. So now here's the key point. If we prepare a coherent superposition of up and down trajectories with arbitrary coefficients and put that into our apparatus with the environmental state, then we get the coherent superposition of up tensor left and down tensor right with the environment in these two different configurations. But now we know at the end of the day, when you look at the pointer, you either find the pointer to the left or to the right. And so the state after the measurement is going to be conditioned on left, the output state is up, and conditioned on right, the output state is down. But the point is that the final state isn't somehow up or down, but this linear combination of the two.
Well, how do you know? Because you only ever look at the measurement, right? And when you look at the measurement to describe that quantum mechanic, you trace out everything else that you don't need.
No, how do I know? I know because the axioms tell me it's true. I'm not saying I know it empirically. I'm saying the axioms of quantum mechanics imply, with all the axioms except for the projection postulate. So I throw away the projection postulate. The idea is, you know, is the projection postulate like Euclid's fifth axiom? Can I derive it from the other four?
But I mean, is the problem here that you have this apparently macroscopic coherent superposition?
No, that's not a problem. That is a problem, but that's not the problem I'm dealing with.
So the problem is that you have a probability of being on the left, the probability of being on the right, and then that thing determines its claim ended up on one side or the other.
So the point is that now, the point is to get. So here's the point, is the measurement has been done. So this is the state after the measurement. But according to the projection postulate, we want the state after the measurement to be one or the other of these possibilities that's consistent with what we observed. So this is why we need an additional postulate to model the process whereby we ascribe a state to the system trajectory conditional upon the outcome we observe. So somehow I feel like this isn't convincing you that we can't deduce the projection postulate. So maybe I need to tighten this argument a little bit. But you can for the moment maybe take it on faith that, I mean, really there's no, I mean, really I should construct this as a formal proof by contradiction or something rather than just illustrate it. But so take this as an illustration that allowing extra degrees of freedom, describing the apparatus as a quantum system, leads to a final situation which is different from the final situation you get when you condition on the outcome. That's what I'm trying to show you. Anybody else want to?
So you're saying that you will not end up with using quantum mechanics in a higher order space to be on the left.
Right.
Or their kind of solution would be to end up in the right.
Yes.
Or the left or the right.
I mean, maybe I can make the argument.
You really get a probability, a classical probability, in that sense that you've just erased.
Yeah, so the point is this. Now, suppose, to complete the argument, let's see. What unitary quantum mechanics. Predicts for the state of the apparatus of the pointer. So how do we do that? We trace over the row for the apparatus, equal to the trace over the electron's position, and a partial trace over the environment of this final state, it's called phi. And that's going to leave me with left is alpha squared plus beta squared, which then r for right. So where L stands for left and R stands for right. So it predicts an incoherent superposition or a mixture of the two possibilities. But in order to describe future measurements, now we want to describe the outcomes of future measurements on the pointer. So I do the measurement at time, t equals 5 seconds, I look at the pointer, I find some outcome. Now I want to say, what is the state so that I can make future predictions about what the pointer will be when I look at it 2 seconds later. Well, it's going to be the same as what I got the first time. That's what the projection postulate tells you. But the unitary evolution, if I write down a unitary operator on this final state for the 2-second interval, it's still going to be a mixture of these two states. It's not going to decrease the entropy or increase the purity of the system. So the point is, Schrodinger evolution, all it can ever tell you is this convex combination, which means a probabilistic division of these two states. So you really need the projection postulate to move forward and have a description of the setup that's consistent with what you know you will see. In the back, what's your name? Sorry?
Andy. So in the first line, let's say chi prime represented the state describing you looking at the pointer and saying, realizing it's left. And chi double prime represented the state describing you looking at the pointer and realizing it's right. Then how could you, is there any way in principle that you could distinguish that from a pure projection?
Oh, what do you mean by a pure projection?
Well, I'm trying to understand how that last line follows. Because in that particular situation, I mean, how could you distinguish? I mean, how do you know that you're not just in a superposition, too? I mean,
okay, well, it sounds like you're kind of espousing a kind of a many worlds type view.
I don't know what I'm espousing.
Well, it sounds like that. So that is a way of handling this. So a lot of modern foundations, in particular interpretations, deals with the idea of trying to come up with our interpretations without observers, and so without collapse. So they do want a formulated interpretation which doesn't have a collapse rule, and the many worlds interpretation is one route to that. In my view, you give up a lot, though, namely reality. So it kind of... like throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Before you go further, in the equation you've written there, don't you get the same problem if you do classical polynomials? You say the world is not deterministic, mm-hmm. but there is some probability of things coming in. You arrive at the state there, and then to move forward, you need to have some kind of classical.
It's exactly true.
Projection.
Yes, it's exactly true. So this is one of the main arguments for rejecting von Neumann's hypothesis that the quantum state is literally real. Because the same collapse rule occurs in classical probability theory. So we'll actually see that in the next lecture, how if you have probabilistic information about a set of possible outcomes, and then you gain some information, like in the Monty Hall problem, one of the doors is open, then you have to change your probabilistic description of the possibilities. And that transformation isn't describable by like Hamilton's equations of motion, for example. It's actually, you know, a Bayesian update rule. And so it's actually a very natural process viewed in the context of probability theory. Now, the reason why that nice explanation doesn't work here is specifically because we're assuming, in the orthodox view, that the state is a physical property. So your update rule, when I'm describing, you know, a game show where I have some probability assigned to the prize being behind one of the doors, and one of the doors is open, and then I update my probabilities, all that's changing when I make that update is my information. There's nothing physically changing about the system. The properties of the system are changing, if my information is changing in that discontinuous way. But when you want to impose this literal realism on quantum mechanics, then that update rule is itself a physical process of the object properties of the system. And this is what makes it, in my view, completely fall apart. It's exactly that. So this is what inspired, you know, Einstein and Ballantyne to write, you know, reams and reams of papers about how absurd this is, and it's exactly that idea, and we'll discuss that in more detail later. Let me find a natural stopping point here. So let me just, you know, in case you don't believe my argument, von Neumann himself acknowledged that, you know, that you can't deduce the projection postulate from the unitary dynamics, which is why it's a postulate, and accepts that there's an awkwardness to that. So he says, we have then answered the question as to what happens in the measurement of an observable. To be sure, the how remains unexplained for the present. This discontinuous transformation from the wave function
into one of the eigenstates of the observable is certainly not of the type described by the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. This latter always results in a continuous change of the wave function in which the final result is uniquely determined and is dependent on the initial state. Whereas here, the outcome doesn't depend on the initial state. It's kind of random, right? It's indeterministic. Let me just take a quick peek here. Okay, I should probably just stop. All right, we'll restart from this point. So there's no lecture on Thursday. You're welcome to come watch the documentary. The documentary on the foundations of quantum mechanics and its impact on technology. Not the foundations, quantum mechanics itself and its impact on technology. It does touch on some foundational issues. So please come to see that. Otherwise, see you next Tuesday.